relationship to people who live under a flag. And my hope is that I won't do most of the talking. I hear my voice pretty much nonstop. I'd like to hear some of your voices. Yeah, my wife is mocking me.
I hear his voice too. So,
I will also say that I'm a PowerPoint virgin. I've never used PowerPoint. And we've already had this lovely bar. My wife, who's the poet in the family, it's crossing the PowerPoint. So I'm hoping this works, but we'll see. So. One other thing, feel free to interrupt me. I don't bite. So crossing Old Glory. And where I want to start is literally thinking about the flag. And I think most of us, even in this room right now, are aware of the flag. We see it. It's common. We see it on baseball fields. We see it in front of schools. We see it in front of churches. We see it on lawns. It's really a shared part of our visual environment. It gives us a sense of place. It tells us where we are. It locates us. So it's about place. It's about space. It's about all those things that sort of give us a sense of home.
If you're a few miles north,
you'd
see a maple.
Yes, we would. Well, I think the fun thing about a flag is it's not unique to the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, nations have flags, and we are identified in some ways by our flag. I was speaking to Michael next door earlier. I lived in Europe for a while, and I actually sewed a Canadian flag in my backpack because I did not want people to identify me as an American.
Yeah. So you're from Canada.
No, I'm from, well, not I'm from Minnesota, but I grew up in the United States till my whole life.
I see.
One thing that is sort of unique about the flag, and I hope I'll explain this well, is that each flag is a flag. And if we remember within the last 15, 20 years, that there's been a lot of debate about burning the flag. And if the flag was just an imitation or a copy of the flag, it might not be sacrilegious to burn the flag. But because the flag, each flag represents what it is, it has a clear sense of what it is. That might sound a little bizarre, using isness as a lot, but the flag is the flag. It means something. And each flag means the same thing, no matter where it is, no matter what's on. That shirt, we see the flag and we think of something. Culturally, it's symbolic in that sense.
But that begs a question, like, so is the flag on the t-shirt the flag? So then is it illegal to burn that t-shirt? Or if it were? Does it, what, you know,
I think that's a great question.
First of all, it's not illegal to burn.
Right,
it's
right.
A picture of the flag.
Right.
It's a representation.
No, I think that's a great question. I do think so. And there clearly is a divisive debate about this kind of attitude. I mean, I think there are clearly people who want a flag-burning amendment to the Constitution. So, and there, you know, there's a U.S. flag code that talks about things like no flag should ever touch anything beneath it, such as the ground, the floor, water, or merchandise. The flag should never be carried flat or horizontally, but always aloft and free. I'm not sure what free means there, but the flag should never be used the flag should never be used as apparel, bedding, or drapery.
Apparel?
In other words, it's not in the fraternity.
That's a picture.
I see.
Well, this is where we get into those debates about what the flag is. Some people think it is the flag. Other people not so much.
I would say you wouldn't use the flag as a cape.
Well, someone today used the flag as a cape.
I know, I've seen it too, but I think that's what it would be saying, that you shouldn't do that, according to the flag code.
And the flag code has only been around since the 20s.
First Amendment was around before the flag code.
Yes, very much so. Well, actually, yeah, very much so. The flag is also part of our shared national heritage and language. I mean, how many people grew up saying the Pledge of Allegiance? And you'd say it to the flag. In fact, if we go further, arguably the flag has a system of belief behind it. It's a creed. I pledge allegiance to the United States of America. and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
That's when they added
and
the under God.
In 1954, they added the under God. And I'll talk a little bit about those additions to the flag once we get there. Yes?
How many people know that the Pledge of Allegiance was originally written by a minister who had socialist leanings and who thought it would be a good thing, not just for the United States, but for every country, including like France, for instance, with a republican form of government?
No, I didn't know that. What was his name?
I think it was Francis Bellamy. I'm not sure. But...
I actually don't know. I don't know. But I'll talk a little bit about why they added one nation under God.
Which is one phrase. It's not one nation under God.
Right.
Being a musician.
But I don't know if anyone saw this either. The U.S. Open recently. Did anyone hear about this? Yeah, you're nodding your head. Would you share with us what you were saying?
NBC left out the under God clause, and people are saying that it's a godless socialist network.
We already copied it. It was written by a socialist.
Well, but obviously people don't know that, and people, mm-hmm. Again, these are the, I think the amazing thing about the flag, because in some ways it's just a piece of material, but it brings out all these deep emotions and this deep sense of meaning and this deep sense of identity, really, which also includes sacrifice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of our presidents didn't think it was fit to have the cameras at wherever it was in Delaware.
Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. I still think they have a blackout of showing bodies coming back from Iraq and
Afghanistan.
So there's lots of things wrapped up. It's also a symbol of protest. Anyone read what the flag says?
Peace?
No.
Die.
It's not a word many of us like to use.
Cool.
Oh.
Yeah. Let's move on to the next slide.
Well, I mean, my point here is this is from the 60s. And those of you who grew up in the 60s, I was not one of you. Those of you who grew up in the 60s, I mean, there were lots of burning of the flag.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a critique of sort of the World War II generation by those who were Vietnam-era generation, that they were sort of critiquing using the flag. And this is a painting by a woman named Faith Ringel. And she's African-American. This is from 1969. And this is called Flag for the Moon, Die Nigger. I mean, what does this evoke?
Rage.
Why? Okay. Why? Let's. I want to explore that a little bit. Why does it evoke rage?
It's quiet. It's desecrating the flag.
Okay. Other thoughts?
No, for me, it's more what it says.
Yeah, I'm more.
No, I don't really care. It's on the American flag. It's what the words say.
1969. That's how it was.
Yeah.
Now, this flag was not done by the Ku Klux Klan. It was done by
an African American.
An African American woman. So that makes it entirely different.
But I don't know that, right?
I don't think. Well. She's made
the justice for all.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. That's absolutely right. I mean, in a lot of ways, like Martin Luther King, a lot of his speeches have to do with saying the United States has all this rhetoric about the free and equality, but we don't live it. And in many ways, I think faith is using this symbol of freedom and justice for all in a deconstructive manner. So, and it works. I saw this, mm-hmm. I was like, whoa. Not just because of what it says, but just, is this appropriate? So why is this important? And this is where we'll get some obscure language. There's an anthropologist, his name is Clifford Geertz, he died in 2006. He's been pretty influential, both in terms of religious circles, but just general sort of Western concepts of religion. And what he talked about is, he tries to define religion, and there's lots of different ways to define religion. And we're not here to explore those, because we'd be here a long time. But what he does talk about is that religion is a system of symbols. If you think about Christianity, what are our symbols?
The cross. The
cross. What else?
The lamb, the fish, the man.
Dove. Yeah. And I see you have a Numa card, so I'm assuming you're, are you Jewish?
Yes.
So what are your symbols?
Well, the main, the most recent, the Magen David, or the Star of David, which is on top of this Mayan, Guatemalan, Mayan-made, yarmulke, which is made because of, came to me via Maya Works, which is an organization that's trying to help Mayans develop, use their traditional weaving skills to make a better life for themselves. Is the star is actually a pretty recent, only medieval thing. The most ancient symbol has been the seven-branched candlestick known as the menorah, which became nine branches for Hanukkah. And those Hanukkah things are not the real menorah, are considered, actually have a different name. The Hanukkah menorah has actually got a different name in Hebrew, Hanukkiah. But that's basically been the main symbol within Judaism. And since the star is now on this, the Magen David is now on the official flag of the state of Israel, this leads to arguments about are we identifying it's become kind of a national symbol as well as a religious symbol, since Israel, most Jews don't think of Judaism as just a religion. There are a lot of non-religious Jews who identify as Jewish, and it's very hard to define what Jewish is nowadays. Much harder than Christianity.
But Gertz's point is that religions use symbols. And in a lot of ways, what I've talked about were how the flag, it shapes our sense of place. It shapes our sense of national identity. There's a language behind it. And for Gertz, the symbols establish powerful, pervasive, and long-lasting moods. And I suspect, those of you who are Christian, you see a cross and you have a reaction. And that reaction is not just temporary. In fact, why do Christians have crosses in their churches? Partially because it establishes those. It trains us. It helps us practice. It helps us enter into a discipline of formation as Christians. You know, I have a 22-month-old, and you know, we take her to church, goes to nursery. What do we want to do? Even though we don't do necessarily a particularly good job of it, but we want her to read the Bible. The Bible has pictures of crosses in it. The Bible has pictures of Jesus in it. You know, at that age, you start them out young, obviously, and you sort of inculcate those kinds of formative moments such that you're trying to shape them, form them. And what Gertz then says is the symbols establish these moods, and these moods are connected to and established to general conceptions of the order of existence. Now, that's kind of jargony. Academics are very good at jargon. Really what Gertz is saying here is that they establish a worldview, a sense of good and evil, a sense of what's right and what's wrong, a sense of behavior, a pattern of seeing the world. It really helps you see the world. And Gertz is assuming here that we have to be trained into a system of values. We're not just sort of born with them, that culture gives it to us. And if you are part of a religious system, that enculturates you into that system. That this worldview, through the symbols, contains an aura of facticity. That's one of those words I like to say 28 times because I can't say it twice. Facticity basically means you think they're real. I mean, if you think about the cross, that we see the cross as Christians, and The cross is real to us. It's a living symbol. It's not just a thing. It's not just plastic or wood or ceramic or stone. It's real to us. We feel it. We experience it. And a lot of ways, worship enacts that feeling too. You know, crosses in our worship spaces. And the moods and motivations that attach to the symbols then take on that sense of facticity. Is this at least good enough for us now to... Yes, I see some eyes glazing over, yes.
So would you say that like the flag, every cross is the real thing? And I'm talking as an outsider, asking the question as an outsider.
That's a good question.
What?
No, it's a good question.
Is the cross, like, is every cross the one on which Yeshua was crucified on, according to, especially, of course, those that there actually is a figure of Yeshua being crucified on? Is everything exactly the same cross?
Anyone want to answer that one?
At different kinds of crosses.
Well, I would say that, the cross, no, but that would apply to a Christian understanding of the Eucharist. The theology of the Eucharist would say that we are with Jesus in precisely the same way that, as precisely as authentic a way as the 12 were on that night. So that I think that correspondence would apply to the Eucharist. I don't think for the cross, but for the Eucharist.
And as from a Jewish point of view, you could say that we've got the cross for Christians is a crown. It's known as a crown symbol, which of course is something that formerly Christian scholar who's currently Jewish, but at one time was a Christian theologian, Mary Potter, teaches us that our crown symbol is the going out of Eden, whereas the crucifixion and the Last Supper are crown symbols for Christians. The one for the Jewish people is the going forth from Egypt, which actually is related to the Eucharist because, let's face it, what were they doing on the Last Supper?
Heather, could you just go back one, and I want to ask a question.
Sure. And I'd be also, let me just say this before I do that, Peter, but I'm going to, having done the Gertz part, the definitional part, I'm going to talk a little bit about the flag and the flag's part in the idea of civic religion. That there's a number of thinkers who basically suggest that the flag is a part of American civic religion, and the way it's used within our political discourse sort of becomes about this worldview and this facticity and this reality that we think of as free and individualism. So
that's what my question was about. And if you look at Goetz's question, is patriotism or nationalism really fit as a religion by his definition, using the flag as the primary symbol?
That's where I'm going.
Yeah, that's what
so I can either jump ahead or we can stick with that.
No, I just thought it would be fun to look at those five in terms of not thinking about the cross, but thinking about patriotism.
Well, what I want to do is sort of deconstruct the flag. And the flag has not always meant what it means today. And here's a picture sort of Betsy Ross showing the flag. And sort of the American myth of the flag is that George Washington asked Betsy Ross to sew the flag. But there's no evidence from George Washington that that was actually the case. And the flag itself, in terms of Betsy Ross, it wasn't until the late 1800s, in actuality it was 1870, when Betsy Ross's grandson said that George Washington had asked Betsy Ross to make the flag. Before the Civil War, the flag represented sort of the 13 colonies as they broke away from the British. Didn't mean much more than that. In fact, there's lots of debates about what the flag was. The flag itself wasn't adopted until 1777, when the Continental Congress resolved that the flag of the United States shall be 13 stripes, alternate red and white, that the Union be 13 stars, white on a blue field, representing a new constellation. So, Civil War is also the first time that there is documented evidence of a flag being placed in or on a church. There was a church in New York City, Grace Church, that they put the flag atop of the steeple. It was 260 feet high. It's sort of a symbol of what they thought the Union stood for in the fight against the rebel Confederates. And it wasn't freedom and equality. So, but after the Civil War, the flag begins to take on new and sort of other more divisive meanings. Does anyone know U.S. history in the 1870s or 1880s? I know what I know doing this, but I just... The United States in the late 1800s was experiencing a flux of immigration. And the WASPs, who had been there first, were being replaced by the Irish Catholics, the Polish, the Catholic Poles, the Slavs, who were also Catholics. Well, the...
Jews, too.
Italian.
What?
Also Jews. We came from a lot of the same places.
Yep, absolutely. Good point. Thank you. Thank you for putting that in. So, of course, they're, you know, even worse than the Catholics for the Protestants. My point being that the sons and daughters of the American Revolution started to establish this myth of what the flag represented. And if you think about it, what's Betsy Ross, or who is she? She's a woman. Anglo-Saxon woman. What is she doing here?
Sewing.
What are the men doing?
Nothing.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Solving the world's problems. Where is a woman supposed to be?
In the kitchen, sewing.
So not only do you have this establishment here of sort of a critique of those un-American elements that are moving into the United States, changing the identity of the United States that this myth is a part of, you also see an establishment of sort of proper social roles and gender roles along with the establishment of the flag. It starts to be used this way, much more and more so. And you see this in the early 20s, too, 1920s. The immigration, it's still true today. You know, obviously, my generation now, it's Mexico. You know, what are we going to do? We've got to protect our borders. We don't want the United States to change. In Minnesota, like I suspect a lot of the states here, I don't know if Washington's like this, but should government documents be in more than one language? Or should they be in multiple languages? And of course, Minnesota just elected a legislature that supports English only. If you're going to come here, you have to adhere to our ways.
Didn't the legislature dissolve for lack of money?
That's our ways.
Yeah, that's fortunately, we elected a Democratic governor by like 7,000 votes. So, but
Band-Aid.
What?
That's a mandate, yeah, according to Scott Walker.
That's true.
Walker.
That probably is.
It's a mandate only if it's Republicans.
That's true.
Even if you got 99% of the vote, it's you haven't had a, and you're Democratic. You don't get a mandate. Only Republicans have them. Republicans have a God-given right to rule.
That goes to, in some ways, the flag has begun to represent, even today, American exceptionalism. And I use Iwo Jima here because, you know, World War II was the good war, where the United States took the mantle of power because the rest of the nations were screwing things up. And I've been a little coy there, but I think there's some truth to there. And I know Obama, in the last 4 or 5 years, when he was running for president too, people were concerned that he didn't believe in American exceptionalism. That we are a shining city on the hill. You know, it's the rhetoric that Reagan brought into the United States in a lot of ways. He restored it. It's part of our history. It's part of the early Puritan pastors and whatnot. But I do think the flag represents American exceptionalism. We're the land of the free. And nowhere else could we do what we do here. I put just causes in here, but in the sense that I think the flag, for many people, even today, has become to symbolize something more than just national unity. it symbolizes true Americans. That you're a true American if you say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. You're a true American if you're willing to ensure that you adhere to the flag code. You protect the flag. You burn it if you improperly use it. That's how you dispose of it. It also demarks boundaries. You're a citizen if you have loyalty to the flag. You're excluded if you don't. I mean, the boundary here is, you know, a couple meanings. Obviously, the fact is that we are near Canada, and if we cross into Canada, there's a different flag. It's telling us that. The flag works that way. And then going back to the Betsy Ross issue, it's about gender. Women belong in the home. They should sew. It's also true that the flag in the early part of the 1900s was when the women's suffrage movement was going on. And the flag began to be brandished, saying, what's the proper role? Betsy Ross. How dare you upset sort of the American exceptional roles that women are supposed to play? Yes?
But meanwhile, I was sitting there thinking, if Betsy Ross has the skill required to make a flag, why can't she vote?
I'm certainly not going to argue against that.
You can't make a flag just being without having any kind of brains.
Well, but see, they would, of course, I think the assumption here is that Betsy Ross would be so busy sewing that she wouldn't be able to be involved in politics. Because politics takes intelligence.
Yeah, but her sewing is basically a form of politics.
Yeah, that's probably true. You know, Faith Ringgold would agree, or Slamming the Moon. I also think that in the last 10 years, the flag has taken on a different name.
Thanks to Sean Hannity.
I'm sorry?
Thanks to Sean Hannity.
Say more.
Hmm?
Say more. I know of Sean Hannity, but I've seen him on Fox News. But, like, what do you mean it's taken on?
Well, that's everything you just said on the previous slide, that's what he says. And that audience to Fox News is enormous.
Kyle?
Yeah, I mean, I think it stands not only for a country, but also stands for ideals of freedom and justice. It's not just our country, it's these ideals on which the country is based.
Sure.
Which, I'm not sure if that is a new thing, but that's kind of what I think.
No, I think that's entirely true.
But it was like before when President Bush, if you challenged President Bush, you were challenging the American flag.
But in the past 10 years, it's become sort of, if you don't wear a flag pin on your lapel, then you're suspect as
right.
an American.
Like President,
you're probably a terrorist.
Senator Obama, during the election, kept getting harassed mm-hmm. constantly. Where's your pin? Where's your pin?
I think we have a fireman in the back, too.
Do you want to know what the best thing about this picture is?
Sure.
I got to meet the guy who's on the far left. They stole that flag off of a yacht. they got on a boat in Brooklyn because they couldn't get into the city. There was like 40 firemen standing on a dock. They came off. They couldn't get to the pier, so they climbed up on top of this yacht, and they took the flag with them as they went. As they went to the Twin Towers, and this was after both towers had fallen, but you know they found a piece. It was just a real organic thing. But the best part of it was a flag that was stolen off of a 70-foot yacht.
It worked very well.
Well, you know, going back to this picture, anyone know the history of this picture?
Yes.
Yeah, it's Iwo Jima, but.
That's the second
stage.
Yeah, that's exactly. This is for the cameraman.
For the
camera. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But they put a smaller flag up there, they went up, took it down,
right.
brought a photographer up, and restaged the photo.
Right.
And then when you talk about true Americans, wasn't Ira Hayes the speaker?
Ira Hayes
was
part of
it.
Yeah.
Was one of these guys.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Drunken Ira Hayes, don't forget that.
Well, we're not going to go there.
Yeah.
My point being, and I think this goes back to both something Kyle said and something Peter said, is that, you know, one of the ways I want us to think about it is, how is this a religion? How is this a symbol that works to communicate meanings that all of us sort of are a part of, sharing? Freedom, justice, truth. Because I think it is a powerful symbol. I mean, it always sort of surprises me coming up here because we're so removed, so to speak, from the world. And yet, July 4th, how many of us are wearing flag pyramid? We do it not only because it's the 4th, but it means something. It's not arbitrary. But what does it mean?
I think it means different things based on your position in society. If you see in the flag justice and liberty and freedom, you probably expect those things from your country. But in 2001, when my Muslim friends saw this flag, that's not what they were receiving, and that's not what they were seeing. They were seeing fear. They were seeing, I have to run away from this right now. And I think that especially in the last decade, the flag has been used to define ourselves in opposition to the other more than who we are on our own.
Other thoughts?
But can't you say that about just about any symbol being misused? I would think there's probably people that would, Muslims that would fear seeing somebody coming at them on the cross too, because there are Christians that would view the cross in a militant way. There's going to be a downside to just about any symbol.
Sure.
Sometimes symbols are by accident. When the Pope was here 10 years ago, whenever it was, and they had the big service at St. Patrick's Cathedral, the men, clergy, were wearing all these colors. They were just like brilliant birds. And they let in a couple peacocks. And they let in a couple of nuns. And they were blackbirds. Because they were all dressed. They didn't get to wear the beautiful garments that the men got to wear. It was real apparent to me watching on television that was a symbol.
Status and hierarchy. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Other thoughts? Or?
I wonder if you give too much credit for mindfulness to people when they wear the symbols, whether it's the flag or a cross, that it sometimes these things become cosmetic and mindless,
sure.
and it's not with ritual and mindfulness that we don a flag or we put on a cross. But you know, if you took a poll out here on the road, you might not have found people thinking deeply about what the symbols they were wearing were. And I think that kind of cuts both ways. It's become pervasive. It's just in the water. We're all fish swimming in this water. It's just in the water, and we don't think about what's in the water anymore.
Sure.
But that speaks to the power and pervasiveness of the symbol.
Of course, what are we called to be as Christians, or Jews, for that matter, dealing with those political symbols? And I sort of want to move there, partially because we have a model, a Christian model, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in a lot of which had to deal with this very issue in a very real way. And I'm hoping most of you are familiar with Dietrich, or should I say something a little bit about him, or? I will say something about him, I will not assume. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran theologian. He was born in the early 1900s in Germany. And he, brilliant guy, took a PhD in theology, I think at 22. And very sort of influenced by both the sort of Lutheran tradition, but another Christian thinker named Karl Barth influenced him heavily too. And Karl Barth was very sort of antagonistic towards the world. The world was sort of a very corrupted place, and the only thing we know about God is what God tells us. It's sort of top-down in that sense. And Barth sort of fused this together, and he was also from a very wealthy family. I think his father was a psychiatrist, very well-known psychiatrist, a very sort of well-established family at the time. And he had to make choices when the Nazis took over the German state. Among other things, he had to make a choice whether to stay in Germany. If he had an out, he could have taught at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and he said no. He stayed in Germany. And he established something called the Confession Church, or he was one of the leading figures in the Confession Church. And he established a seminary as well. And the seminary was sort of an alternative vision. And you see a lot of sort of Bonhoeffer references at Holden. If you go look in the bookstore around here, just because Holden, I don't think explicitly is sort of thinking about Bonhoeffer, but certainly Bonhoeffer's frustration with the political realm and the nation state are in Holden's sort of identity. And what he reacted to was something that I think makes all of us today sort of squeamish that something like this could happen. And this is from a book written by, I think his name is George Hahn, and this is from, I think, 1935 or 36. And it was called The Cross of Christ and the Swastika. And this pamphlet says this: remember that you are a Christian people, carried by the eternal love of the Heavenly Father, free through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, sanctified by the power of God's Spirit. The swastika, however, points to the world as a divine creation and admonishes us: remember that you are German, born in German territory to parents of German blood, filled with the German spirit and essence, formed according to German nature. Both together, however, the cross of Christ and the swastika admonish us: remember that you are German Christian people and should become ever more whole German Christian people and remain so. I looked for a picture of a swastika in a church, and I found a couple, but they were really poorly, the images are bad. So, but you get a sense of what Bonhoeffer was dealing with, that the flag becomes united with the cross. And I think the tension that we as Christians sort of should think about, I think your point is good, Sean, but we don't really think about some of the things we do. So that, aren't we as Christians asked to think about what we do and think about the world that we are a part of? And Bonhoeffer did that, obviously. He did it to the point where he was killed. He was in late, I think, April of 1945, he was finally hanged. He'd been in prison for a long time. He wrote a lot when he was in prison, because he had made the decision that at some point it's okay to assassinate those who are demonic, really. And he had a couple reasons why this was the case. And the first is the four mandates. For Bonhoeffer, there are four mandates. And four mandates basically mean that God has established certain types of relationships for all of us, and there are four of them. There is work, marriage, church, and the nation state. All of them are interrelated, and all of them should check each other. In the sense that, for instance, going to something in particular what he talked about, that the Nazi state established blood purity laws in terms of who you could marry and who you could not marry. And Bonhoeffer said that was the mixture of the marriage mandate with the government mandate, because marriage is separate from the government. So you should be allowed to marry who you're going to marry. You shouldn't have those requirements, those laws that you have to adhere to. Overall, Bonhoeffer also thought that the world is a gift of God. That creation is good, that government is good, for instance, that marriage is good, work is good, churches are good. But the problem or demand that God places on us is that we are to be Christians within those mandates. Christian husband, Christian employee, Christian governmental official. What that also means is that we had to maintain the divinely inscribed natural value of church, world, work, family, and government. And natural in there might not seem important, but it was crucial for Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Because what were the German Nazis doing in the 30s?
They were using Christianity as the Jews.
Well, the Jews, disabled people, mentally handicapped.
Homosexuals,
gypsies.
Yeah.
Slavs, eventually, once they took over
the gypsies, yeah.
Impurities.
Yeah.
Gypsy.
Yeah.
And cigar, I mean Roma.
Yeah, the Roma, sure. Well, life has value. God has given life value. Not just Christians, but other religious folk do. And all life has value because it's inscribed by God. So there's natural value in the church. There's natural value in work. There's natural value in family and there's government. It's a limit we cannot cross. And Bonhoeffer pushed this idea of natural life. And you can see why he agonized. And he agonized over whether it was okay to assassinate Hitler. He eventually decided it was. Because what the Nazis did is they screwed up the proper order of things. That the nation is a penultimate good. I mean, our government, what does our government do?
Nothing.
The civic over here.
Whatever it is, it's wrong.
Oh, come on. Let's think of some good things the government does. We're all
for
beneficiaries.
Drugs,
of
public safety.
Education.
Parks.
Thank you.
Medicare.
Medicare, yes.
If it's Canada's government, healthcare for
yes.
Health care for all in this country.
Yeah, sure. The issue, though, becomes if you move sort of the word of God, which is the ultimate, that word is always limiting to us. It always puts us in our place, the law. It's grace-filled, but it always challenges us and reminds us that we are sinners, that we can never get beyond sin. The problem is if you switch them, like the Nazis did, that the state, German blood, became higher than Christianity. Volk became higher than Christianity. And along with that, the flag becomes ultimate, not the word of God.
Hitler was quite desperate to have a meeting with the Lutheran hierarchy, and they resisted for a period of time, but then they met with him. There's a famous picture of the heads of the Lutheran German church meeting with Hitler and smiling and shaking hands, putting their stamp of approval.
And that's why the confessing church arose. But my father was a Lutheran minister. He was a chaplain during World War II, and he was in Germany in 1938. Attending some kind of Lutheran, scholarly thing, he said. Anyway, I don't know if he could speak German or not, but he knew what was going on. And when he came back to this country, he wanted to tell people, but they didn't want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And after the war, I have sermons that he wrote when his congregation was often very ethnic, and they felt responsible for what had happened, and other people held them responsible. They were German Lutherans, and they didn't stand up to Christianity. So it took me a long time to figure out what this one sermon was about.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just didn't make any sense. And then I figured that out, because it talks about good things the Germans have done. great musicians, great writers, great thinkers, great poets. And that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to comfort his congregation, who, even though they had fought, but all those things that happened, especially because he could not get anybody to listen to him when he came back from Germany, it made a very big impression on him and for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As a Jew, I felt a little bit uncomfortable when during the 4th of July parade, when that fun, the mechanics came through with that little thing that looked like a tank blaring at the top of the loudspeaker, wonders, right as a bug flutings. I think a Bugs Bunny, somebody that Bugs Bunny.
I think they were doing Apocalypse Now because they're all wearing military uniforms. That great scene in Apocalypse Now where they fly in to go surfing.
Right, that's kind of made a little bit more scary. At least nobody was wearing a swastika. A swastika what?
Well, I can identify that. Well, we have about 15 minutes or so, but I want to end today with the question, so what? And I also want to end with a Bible verse. That's from Ephesians. But God forbid that I should glory except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. So what?
I think one of the blessings of our existence here in this country is those two things are not in conflict with each other, at least to a large extent. They aren't in my life. And I think if they are in conflict with each other, we've got a really difficult choice to make a la Bono. That becomes untenable in a lot of ways. And we're very fortunate to not have to deal with the fact that the cross should be worn and the flag too.
It's sort of scary. I mean, I'm from South Carolina, and as everybody knows, it is our role in the world to do something that will make everybody else laugh at us. We let people that do bizarre things Secretary of Education was previously the president of Newberry College, which is a Lutheran college. He campaigned as president of a Christian college. And in South Carolina, that means evangelical. That means, Newberry, the people that they have there that who think, they really struggled with that, because that guy was saying, I am Christian, therefore I don't, the right-wing stuff that goes with the evangelical movement. He wouldn't say, I'm Lutheran, and they put, what's their identity? They're a Christian college, that's right, what does that mean? And it was a very, I think, very, very scary thing, among the many scary things that happen in South Carolina. And not perhaps as entertaining as some of them.
Well, I have the exact opposite reaction to this gentleman over here. I feel a conflict repeatedly. I mean, every time I see policies like the laws they're passing down in Arizona to exclude immigrants by the different kinds of, our global attitude that, life of Afghanistan people is less important than a life of an American person. Just so many, just in almost every area, that our net worth individually is more important than providing health care uniformly for people who need it. Just issue after issue after issue, I see a direct conflict for me between these two.
Our Christian Secretary of Education will not accept federal money for education in South Carolina, which is a very poor state, and particularly in some parts with very, very bad education system, because he is a Tea Party person. Yes. And he's holding up that as a Christian way of managing, of being a politician. That is Christian.
I think one of the things that I've never heard the concept of facticity. It's a great word.
It's about a cocktail party.
After the third cocktail, it's hard to say. People in this country are advancing whatever their ideology is, whether it's religion, politics, red, blue, tea, coffee, espresso, with a certainty of fact that none of these ideas actually deserve. The rhetoric soars to this level of certainty and factitude. I mean, it's not facticity, it's just fact. It just is. You listen to Fox News, you listen to Keith Olbermann, you listen to anybody, and they speak with conviction of truth that is almost divine, whether it's politics or religion. They are right. Anyone who disagrees with them is wrong. Anyone who disagrees with them is probably crazy. And it has, whether it's politics or whether it's, you know, Presbyterian or Lutheran, there are discussions that happen here in the village where Palestine and Israel come up. And there's a factitude, there's a certainty and righteousness in the speech that is almost unquestioned. And that's what's happened in our discourse today. That we talk about politics, every idea has the same certainty as sun rising and setting and the nature of God.
And the best way to give it that factitude is to attach it to the cross or attach it to the flag. And it can't be a sail. And, you know, kind of then to your point over there, then it becomes an image of whatever that person wants to espouse. And it can have negative connotations or a positive. But is it truly Christianity? Or is it truly in line with what the U.S. Constitution says we should be doing? I mean, not everybody that holds up the flag is, I would say, doing what they're supposed to be doing according to.
But it creates this straw man.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
If you disagree with me, you're obviously
American. Yeah, then you're against everything that America stands for, everything Christianity stands for. Yeah, good point.
Almost every church I've ever been inside has a cross on the left of, I mean, sorry, a flag on the left of the cross. So it's not in the place of the cross, it's not above the cross, but it's always there, right in the front. And I've always felt very, well, not always, but I feel uncomfortable about that because of these things that are, these tensions that we have between what we confess as a faith and what the flag means. But then I think about the chapel at St. Olaf College, or here at Holden, there is a American flag, and it might even be in the most prominent place, but there's lots of other flags. You know, there's a flag of Canada, there's a flag of, well, anyways, almost, you know, 40 countries, and by having those in a chapel or here, where everything here seems to have a sense of holiness, or that's not affirming everything that every flag, every nation represented by every flag has done, but it's a way of saying it's almost the opposite of having a single flag. It's saying the God that we believe in is the God of all of these flags, and is over all of these flags, and includes all of these flags.
Mm-hmm. In dealing with our symbols, we still have allowed pop singers to absolutely massacre the Star Spangled Banner. As in, you know, really massacre it. So, I know.
Kyle. The gentleman, I know you had your hand up for...
Me?
Yeah.
Now, regarding the Israeli-Arab conflict, we have a lot of that in our community, too. For instance, I basically take what I consider a pretty mild pro-peace position, which is, you know, there should be a Palestinian state in West Bank and Gaza, and at least a good many of the settlements should be removed. There should probably be a swap of what, if Israel gets some land, it should return, give some land to the Palestinians. Somebody who used to believe that, but then went to Israel and found and discovered that Israel is basically in a very funked out position. Most people seem to be very angry about something, and they came back and told me that I was basically this is a friend. That I was that people there see me as basically a threat to their survival. And I'm somebody who's always considered myself, who spent a year in Israel, considered myself a Zionist, left-wing Zionist. And might even have an argument with some people here about maybe a little bit more enthusiastic about the Palestinian side. I'm not too enthusiastic about the politics on both sides. And
that would be a fun session.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm interested in the whole understanding of civil religion as it plays out, not necessarily in theory, but just in reality. I was most recently a pastor in a small town in Minnesota, and civil religion was alive and well. And most of the people that would take part in, for instance, a National Day of Prayer session in Central Park, most of the people there weren't, you know, rabid civil religious people, but they were just people that thought it's a good thing that we'd get together and have a National Day of Prayer or whatever. And I hated being a part of it just because it was, you know, we had some of the pastors that, you know, wanted to really, we had to have the Pledge of Allegiance at this, you know, we couldn't do the creed, but we could do the Pledge of Allegiance at a prayer service, and most of the people in town didn't understand any. It was just, yeah, we're coming together as a community and let's have this prayer together, but underneath it was this incredible civil religious stuff that just cemented even more together the understanding of we are a Christian nation. And for those who weren't Christian, I can't imagine what that must have felt like to be in that town, because there were lots of people that were not Christian. And yet, you know, people in town said, well, we're all Christian. Well, they weren't. And so to sort of stand up and say, you know, if you're anybody, this is what we are, it must have been abhorrent to some people. And I think that that's where we end up today. There are people that take advantage of that, I think. And I think our politicians are well attuned to that. You know, it's not just by chance that Michelle Bachmann or Tim Pawlenty use that, because they know that it ties into most people that think, well, of course we want to be that way, or of course it's a nice thing to be, without really stopping for a moment and saying, how does this really affect my faith? How does what Jesus say affect how I live it out in my day-to-day existence? And I think that that's a dangerous for us. It's easy for us in a place like Holden to just sit there and take pot shots at everybody else. And we're all the liberal bastion of whatever. But I think, you know, there's a lot of people that really could use a word that is of grace to say, you know, maybe we should think about what does Jesus have to say about this, and enter in a conversation rather than, you know, the ideologies that come out on Fox or MSNBC and just shoot fire guns at each other. I think it's helpful to say, okay, so what? What does it mean when it comes down to this quote by Ephesians? How does that play out in our lives? On a daily basis, with people who are honest, hardworking Americans that see the flag as a good thing and yet don't understand why there's a conflict. And maybe it'd be more helpful to sit there and have that conversation in a way over a cup of coffee, you know, than somehow just sort of shooting at all the government leaders or whatever. And I'm not saying that as, I don't care what my politics are, but I think sometimes we get into these sessions and we just scattergun everything that isn't like us either. And I think that it's really important we don't think about how it affects people on a daily basis either. So that's my
grace-filled word. Yeah.
It strikes me that the problem is perhaps a little bit deeper than that, though, because I think it's a cogent position to say, you know, the cross or the, you know, the crucified Jesus is the only ultimate thing, therefore should not our politics adhere as closely as possible to, you know, our religion. And I think if we this verse points to that, I certainly think, you know, Bonhoeffer and Barth's neo-orthodoxy sort of points to that, that there's only one thing which is real, and therefore everything else should potentially line up with that. And I think politics is necessarily the realm of, you know, compromise and ethics and translatability and all of these things, and so I think we, I often feel as though we've lost the ability to translate between those two things, but I find myself wondering now if we ever really had it. You know, is this a new problem, or is it just our continued struggle to figure out the relation between that which is ultimate and that which isn't, and that which is the realm of compromise? I think our discourse is pretty impoverished on that front, but at the same time, I think there's a coherency to the message that we want to seek to be, you know, as Christian a nation as possible. And I find myself wondering how to productively temper that sense, because it leads to some very ugly stuff.
Well, it's 7:20, so I'd be glad to push this up through Vespers, but... Well, I thank you for your wisdom and your time, and I hope we do think about this tension, because it's there, and it matters to people. So, thank you.